How's it going, everyone? Terry Flower here. I know we don't usually do these warnings before episodes, but this one in particular is distressing at times. This week we're talking to Andrew McGinley. Andrew lost his 3 children a few years ago when they were killed by their mother. He tells us that story and a lot more besides it, much of it around mental health and the mental health system in this country. So please be aware that there's discussion here of the death of children. We don't go into the details of exactly what happened. We let Andrew tell it exactly how he wanted to, but still could be upsetting for people. Besides that though, the episode is not sadness. Andrew is an incredible, inspirational man. I can't even describe it really, you'll have to listen. But there were laughs as well as tears in this one, and a lot of hope. We talk about the incident itself early enough, and then after that there's a lot more hope and positivity. If you are affected by anything you heard in this episode, or just need someone to talk to, call the Samaritans on 116 123. Here's the episode, mind yourselves.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your weight in the ground. Till your body okay. Walk it hard and long. When you finish that,
the hip knocker.
Episode 169 of the Talking Bollocks podcast, brought to you by Go Loud. It's me, COB.
It's me, Terry Flower.
And today we're joined by Andrew McGinley, who has come in to tell us probably the saddest story we've ever heard on the podcast. We're going to get into that in more detail. But first, Andrew, you were just mentioning something there before we got on there about a walk you're doing.
Yeah, so I do. I'm the father of Connor, Darren, Carla, who lost their lives on the 24th of January 2020. I do 3 projects in memory of Connor, Darren, Carla. And Dara's project is a charity called As Dara Did. It's in his memory because he was involved in everything. He was in the hurling, he was in the GA, he was in the soccer, he was in the drama class, he was in everything. So the charity gets people involved, as Dara did, because he was involved in everything. So I realized that as a charity, I needed to come up with an annual event that we could do that would raise funds. So I found great solace, I suppose, in hiking and walking. I've done a lot of that now over the last 4 years. So I decided to do a walk along the Royal Canal from Mullingar to Maynooth. Both places on that route have a lot of meaning to me and with the kids. And that's happening on the 20th and the 21st of April, so in about 10 days' time. And we're looking for donations. So we're on iDonate. We've funded, I think, is 137 projects to date in about 2.5 years since we commenced, and given out over €200,000 to community clubs and groups to help get people involved and to get people included and integrated into their community. So it lifts me. It's a positive, very positive project that I do. So that's As Dara Did, and yeah, you'll find us on iDonate.
Just iDonate. Have you got a social media page?
Connor's project was a social media.
Mm.
So Connor's Clips was a YouTube channel that was based on, I'd promised Connor I would help him with setting up a YouTube channel. So I'm on Twitter and Instagram and Blue Sky and Mastodon and Threads and everything else you can think of as Connor's Clips. But we also have As Dara Did on Instagram, Facebook. I think that's the two that that's on. Yeah. But I think a lot of people would know the projects As Dara Did, Snowman for Carla, and Connor's Clips. If you Google any of them, you'll end up going to the one page where you'll find the As Dara Did walk in the walk.
And you'll get the link to the
iDonate and to the information page as well.
Yeah, so get on there and you'll find the links to donate. So you've mentioned the 3 projects about your 3 children. Do you want to give us a bit of background about the kids? Tell us what the kids were like.
Well, as I mentioned there, Dara was involved in absolutely everything. I'll never forget when we moved to Newcastle. Connor was, there's different ways of describing them. They were funny kids, and I love that because I have an off-the-wall sense of humor, and I think they got that from me. Connor would have been the sort of like very subtle comedy, you know, it would take you a minute or two to get it. Dara would have been the slapstick comedy, and Carla would have been like, you know, she just was a bit of a joker. I'll never forget, she was sitting in her high chair. She must have been about 1.5 or something. She was sitting in her high chair, and she just got some food and threw it on the floor as a baby. And I go, you can't do that, you know. And I was, you know, picking it up. I go, don't be doing that again. And she just looked at me and started laughing. And I thought, oh no, there's 3 of them now. They're going to be taking the piss out of me. But that was just the nature of them. And when we moved into Newcastle, and we moved in on the day, and I was with Connor and Dara in the front room, and they were looking out, and there was a load of the kids. We moved into a small estate, and a lot of the kids were out playing on the green. So I said, listen, do you just want to go out and introduce yourselves or whatever else? And Connor was a bit reserved, going, oh, see, Dara was straight out, and I could see him going up, shaking hands with everybody and introducing himself. He would kind of get that from me a bit, because I suppose with my job and all, I would go to a lot of sort of networking events, and even with the charity, and I'm just straight up here, this is who I am, this, and what do you do? And I'm thinking straight away, can you help me with the charity, or you help me? So Dara was straight, and then Connor eventually went out then, but Dara was able to introduce him to everybody. So yeah, Connor was a smart kid. I would have had no fears. Connor would have studied and been whatever he wanted to be. I think looking at on his YouTube channel, I have I can't call it the Lego movie, but it's the movie with Lego, I've had to call it. But I'd given them an old camcorder, and it wasn't until after they died, I found the camcorder up in their bedroom, and I charged it up, and they had, I think it's about 40 minutes, and they had done a Lego movie with different scenes. And when I put it all together, it's about 40 minutes. So I've put it on his YouTube channel, called it the movie with Lego. But like, there's everything, and it starts off at they were mad into their Lego. They had the Doctor Strange's shop, and they have a lava monster coming to get pizza, and the pizza delivery man, I think, is the Hulk. And you know, it was mad stuff, but it was brilliant. And they had a white blanket up on the door, and they had the shot, and then the white blanket falls down, so that's the avalanche. And so their imaginations were fantastic. And I think Connor would have, like, he had a whole load of homemade comics that he did, so I think he would have been creative and gone into that sort of world. Carla, she would have had everybody wrapped around her finger. And again, I would have had no fears about Carla. Dara, I feel, would have been sleeping on their sofas until his mid-30s. And then he would have met somebody down the pub or out on a night out. And eventually they would have come up with some idea, and he would have been a multimillionaire. That would have been Dara, you know, just, yeah. So that's the three of them in a nutshell. But they were great friends. And there's one great video on Connor's clips on the YouTube channel is I'm sitting on the sofa filming Carla, and she's in her little fairy costume. And she says, I'm going into the lads. So she leaves and she goes out to the front room, and I follow her. And she walks in, the two lads are in the front room playing, like doing something. They might have been watching telly or something. And she waves her wand. She goes, I'm turning you into monkeys. And like, you'd think most kids would turn around and go, get out of here. Well, the two boys start acting as monkeys, and then she turns them into frogs, and they start jumping around pretending that they're frogs. They were just tight like that. They were great, great buddies. And I love that about it. And do you know, there was a very close bond between the three of them, you know.
Mm. Yeah. So this is the part that we didn't actually want to come to, but Andrew, if you could take us through what happened in the events of January 2020.
Yeah. I suppose what is known is, you know, that their lives were taken by their mother, Deirdre Morley. Deirdre had been in treatment for her mental health due to patient confidentiality and the like. I wasn't informed of how bad she was. I would have experienced, I suppose, in the house what they call masking. So I would have seen the mask of all the positive things. So I was away for an overnight trip, and I was coming back, and I had a number of phone calls with Deirdre that day about, you know, I'd be back and what time I expected to be back. And I got news that a friend of mine, his father, had passed away. The wake was on that evening. So I'd actually rang Deirdre to sort of say, I can call in and collect the kids, because Friday we used to do the big shop for the weekend and stuff like this. So I used to bring the three of them shopping with me. So I was even saying, listen, I'll call in, collect the three kids, go over to the wake, because they were good kids. And I know everybody talks about their kids, guy, they were good kids. So I knew that they wouldn't have been causing ructions at a wake or anything. And so I said I'd call and collect them. And she go, no, go on into the wake. But at this stage, the kids were dead. And as I was coming back after the wake, I got a phone call from a neighbour to say that Deirdre had collapsed outside, and there was an ambulance and everybody was there. And I was only a couple of minutes away. And when I got home, the ambulance crew were treating Deirdre. I went over to see, you know, what was happening. They told me, listen, stand back, let us do our work. So I grand. And then I realised, like, where's the kids? And I looked over at the house, and the house was in darkness. And I was just hoping. I hope they're in at the back. of the house watching telly or something. So I went over and opened the door. And there was a note on a bike in the hallway saying, don't go upstairs. And I just looked into the front room and just saw Connor. Connor was there. His body was there. And so I went over and one of my neighbors had come in with me. And he had seen Connor's body and he went straight back out because the fire brigade was there. It was seemingly when you ring emergency services, the ambulance and the fire brigade turn up. And then the Gardaí happened to be passing, I think, and had seen the fire engine and thought they'd come in. So everybody just happened to be there. So a paramedic came in. I was holding Connor in my arms. You're just willing for a sign of life. And there wasn't. Paramedic comes in and says, you know, oh, stand aside. You know, so I moved aside. I just remember she looked at me and it was, yeah, she just shook her head. So then straight away, you're sort of, what about Dara? What about Carla? So the fire, what do you call them? The fire engine team, the fire brigade had gone in and had gone upstairs and they had found Dara and Carla. But I needed to see them. So there was a bit of a wrestling match at the bottom of the stairs. Them trying to keep me from going up, me wanting to go up. And I just remember a voice and it was the captain or the chief fire officer. And he just said, let him go, let him go. And I went upstairs and I found them upstairs. So then, you know, it's just pandemonium. There's Gardaí coming in, there's everybody coming in. And next thing I think the chief superintendent was there and a number of detectives and you're just sitting there and, in bewilderment, you don't know what. I remember thinking to myself, this doesn't happen. This happens in the States or somewhere. This doesn't happen in Dublin. This doesn't happen in Ireland. And now, upon reflection, like I'm speaking to the detectives, but it's only when you speak to them afterwards, yeah, they're questioning me. And you go, well, I was away. And so you're discounted from their inquiries. But you don't realise that everybody's a suspect until... And it's just bizarre then because then your house becomes a crime scene. So I'd been away for a night. So I had a suit and a shirt and I had... That was about it. I had a mountain in my house because it's now a crime scene. So I had to go into a neighbour's house and... I had to make a request then, could I get some clothes, like clean socks and jocks from the house? But I remember standing outside and people speaking to me and I can't even, you're lost, completely lost. I remember the call that I made to my brother. I just said to him, listen, you just need to ring everybody else. Thought about my parents, my mother, I was in the early stages of dementia at the time and I was going, Jesus, I can't ring me dad. I can't ring anybody. My sister was the closest, so I think she was the first of my family that arrived over. But I just remember standing outside the house, looking at the house. It's now a crime scene. I can't go back in. And one of the first thoughts in my head was I hadn't helped Connor set up his YouTube channel. And I'd promised him I would. And that for me, I mean, up to that moment, I was rock bottom. Had you told me a meteor was coming to hit the earth, I would have went, great. Fantastic. But then that spark of I haven't helped Connor set up his YouTube channel. And that gave me a reason to fight on and to do what I'm doing now. So
take a minute.
you might need a minute more than I do. It's emotional chatting about that. It really is. But, you know.
Well, sorry if...
No. I'm always going to get emotional chatting about that. I mean, it's a moment where you're at your lowest. I say, I was rock bottom. You could have told me anything. You told me I was going to be executed in the next 30 seconds. Yeah, so be it.
Yeah.
Couldn't have went any lower. Couldn't. Mm. So I'm quite proud of the fact that I'm sitting here in front of you today, to be honest with you.
Mm, that's...
And I'll get my voice back now in a minute.
Yeah. No, Andrew.
I just wanted, that's what I was just going to do off the bat, was commend you for
being able to sit there in front of us.
Yeah.
Not just sit there in front of us today, but sit there in front of us today and be able to tell that story. But your intentions with telling the story for the charities and all the work that you want to do now to help so many other people off the back of such a traumatic experience, I don't really...
It's hard to put into words, yeah.
You know?
Well, you see, I believed in the lived experience, and I believe that what I've lived through, I can help make changes that would eliminate the risk to children, that would improve patient care and patient safety, and would ensure that nobody else has to go through the torment that I've been through. And I'll fight that campaign until change is made or until I no longer have a breath in my body. Hmm. But it's been frustrating, very frustrating, and driven me to anger and driven me to a lot of different negative emotions that I really don't want, because the kids wouldn't want me to be angry. I know that. But the fact that I've been speaking constantly about how we can eliminate the risk to children, how we can, you know, ensure that this sort of, you could talk about eliminating, but I suppose somebody will always counter argue, you can never completely eradicate, but we can significantly reduce the actual, this happening again.
Yeah.
And it's a couple of simple changes, and it's frustrating that I feel that I'm not being listened to. And this happened back in 2010 to a woman called Una Butler in Cork. Her daughters, Zoe and Ella, their lives were taken. And she campaigned, and she met with the likes of Micheál Martin, who you've had on as a guest here. He pledged his support. Had he helped her to make the changes that she had been seeking, then there's a very good chance that Conor, Darren, Carla would be alive today. Simon Harris, who's now going to be our next Taoiseach, had written to Una Butler. He had made some commitments that have yet to materialise. So I'm hoping that he will keep his commitments that he made to a grieving mother, and that we will soon see an advisory group made up of people who have been through this, who can help the experts, or the, I would feel that we're the experts, that can help interdepartmental groups or the HSE or the mental health services to understand how they can eliminate, for me, the risk to children, the children of mental health patients.
I don't want to go back to the night, but just when was it made clear to you that Deirdre Morley had done what she had done to the children?
She'd left a note. She'd left a note which the Gardaí had found.
Had found.
Yeah.
And then what you're now referring to is she was suffering with her mental health, and she had been speaking to our therapist.
She'd been in treatment with the HSE Mental Health Services and also St. Patrick's Mental Health Services. I had one meeting with St. Patrick's. I feel at that meeting, I can tell you now that I wasn't told the diagnosis that was in Deirdre's medical notes that we heard at the trial. I wasn't told about the suicidal ideation that we heard about at the trial. I wasn't told about the safety concerns that Deirdre had expressed to her clinicians about her being around the children or being a parent of the children. Wasn't told any of that. I feel I was put at ease as opposed to being put in alert. I think I was taken off guard as opposed to being put on guard. And then when you tie in that with the masking that I experienced from Deirdre, because she did not, I know she didn't want me to know how bad she was. I was lulled, I feel, into a false sense of security. I was not informed, not advised, not supported. And I do feel that had I been informed, had I been advised, had I been supported, then Conor, Darren, Carla would be alive today.
When did Deirdre start to show that she was suffering mentally?
She had started treatment. And again, I suppose this is... Her treatment is her story, but 2018, she began seeking support. For me, I would have always said that Deirdre Morley was a worrier. She worried about a lot of stuff. And the way that she talked to me initially about it, it seemed to be more about mindfulness and concerns. And at the trial, we would have heard about aspects that for work, she was employed by the HSE, that there would have been a death of a child that she was looking after. And there was also, she had experienced some bullying within the organization that had taken an impact on her. So for me, that's what she was dealing with. And then her mother had passed away, and she'd been very close to her mother. So my understanding back in 2018 was sort of counseling in relation to a lot of that. But she did go into full-time as an inpatient in 2019. And that's when I had the meeting with the clinician who, as I say, put me at ease. And I was told, yeah, nothing that they were too concerned about, and some treatment and some medication and everything would be fine. But it wasn't fine. And I now feel that as a co-parent, I should have been fully informed, fully advised, and fully supported, because some of the decisions that clinicians were making for their patient were going to have an impact on Conor, Darren, Carla, and I. And I do not feel that those clinicians had a right to make those decisions that were going to eventually impact us as a family. And to now declare that it was sort of done through patient confidentiality, that's doesn't sit well with me, because there is children first legislation in this country. So that should have taken precedence, that once a concern was raised by a patient in relation to their children, children first legislation should have been adhered to and the guidelines of children first should have been followed. And I don't feel that the multiple occasions when Deirdre as a patient declared that she felt she couldn't be a parent, she expressed that she didn't feel safe around the children, all of this unbeknownst to me, but the clinicians were aware of it. So all these multiple occasions of talking about the children to clinicians, and there's children first legislation, and it just doesn't add up to me.
Yeah. Before speaking to you, Andrew, I would have always been on the side of patient confidentiality. I would have always agreed with patient confidentiality until your case gets mentioned now. And you hear, as a co-parent, the other parent has stated that she doesn't feel safe, the children.
Well, I agree with patient confidentiality. I fully support it. I mean, if I was diagnosed with something, I thought, well, that's, you know, that's for me, you know. But I think if decisions were being made about me that were going to impact other people, that's then patient confidentiality goes out the window. And when there's children involved, decisions were made to allow a patient with a suicidal ideation who had expressed concerns about being around her children back home to her children. Mm. That makes no sense to me whatsoever.
That's exactly where I was getting at. It's, I don't think there's a person in not in the country, in the world, who can argue that point.
But it is being argued with me through the inquest, and I believe that there is a civil suit ongoing, which I can't talk about, but I believe defence has been submitted in relation to that. So
why do you feel like they're not working with you here, Andrew?
Well, they didn't work with Una Buckler either. Mm. And that's going back to 2010. I don't understand why nobody has given me a... I hoped that the HSE review into Deirdre Morley's care and treatment would supply some answers. I spent several hours with the review team going through everything. The review was issued to myself, Deirdre, and the HSE and St. Pat's. I read it once. I read it again. And I thought to myself, if I was an independent person, if I didn't know the people involved, I would have thought, do you know something? They should have spoken more to the father. My feedback to the HSE was, whilst there's three or four good things, I'll give them credit that there was three or four good things in the HSE review. My feedback to the HSE was that had I asked them to do a review of the tragedy of the Titanic, they would have came back and said that a ship set sail in cold weather, sank, and some people died. That was the level of detail in it. It also, for me, reeks of professional reverence. And what I mean by that is I spent hours, and I say several hours, it was over the course of 2 days. I think we were 3 or 4 hours each day. And when I read the report, it looks like they spent a 5-minute telephone conversation with the clinicians that they spoke to. It just, and there's a difference of opinion or a difference of recollection between a registrar and a consultant. And in the review, they outline both recollections and they note that there was a conflict. My meeting with the clinician, they have the clinician's version of that meeting, but not mine. So it lacks consistency sort of in that they should have listed what I said about that meeting and noted a conflict. I'm deeply, deeply disappointed with the review. Why certain decisions were made, it doesn't dig into that. It just, you know, states a consultant made this decision, move on. I need to understand why decisions were where certain decisions were made.
You spoke there in detail of what was going on when Deirdre was meeting with clinicians. When did this all come to light to you? Did it take until the trial for that
information? After the trial. At the trial, I was given the opportunity by the Office of the DPP to look at the Book of Evidence, I think the day before the trial. And I I was in a daze. And I think for the whole trial, I was in a daze. One of the, probably what got me was at the trial in the Garda interviews, Connor's last words, Deirdre had said what Connor's last words were. That destroyed me. Yeah. I kind of, in one way, I wish I hadn't known what his last words were. But it was then I'd asked for access to the medical notes and after the trial. So it would have been September 2021 when I went through everything. When I sat down for 3 days in the solicitor's office and went through every single note. And I was stunned. I just can't get my head around why certain decisions were made, why big red flags that were being waved weren't taken notice of. But I'm hoping now that the next process is the inquest in the coroner's court under the annunciations of the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court outline what additional areas that an inquest can look at, and they can look at circumstances that can prevent other deaths. And certainly I would feel that going back to 2018, when Deirdre first commenced attending mental health services, I feel that there's lessons that can be learned that will save the lives of children in the future, and that medical experts and clinicians can learn from. And hopefully, as I say, eliminate the risk to children, improve patient care, and try to ensure that nobody else goes through what I've gone through. My understanding is that there has been at least one submission to restrict the inquest. For me, the positives, save children's lives, ensure nobody goes through and what I've gone through, and patient care, improve patient care. If that's a positive for extending the scope, I can't think of one positive for restricting the scope. And yet, my understanding is there's one submission in. But I would hope that the inquest will look and will realise that it needs to look at the period of treatment and how lessons can be learned and how the lives of children can be saved. And certainly I would say that had there been a number of key decisions made differently, that Conor Darren Carlin would be alive today. And for me, that all falls within the annunciations of the Supreme Court in relation to an inquest. So I'm hoping to hear news any day now of when the inquest is going to recommence. So I'm hoping that that will bring some answers and change.
You said it was September 21 when you went through all these files.
After the trial, yeah.
Yeah. So are you kind of in the dark about all this for over a year and a half?
I remember having a meeting with Mary Butler, who was the Minister for Mental Health, before the trial. And I wish I could have that conversation again, because what I know now and what I knew then, now I know a lot more. And I've spoken to a lot of experts, a lot outside of the country. I feel that Ireland is such a small country that I wanted a sort of unbiased sort of view and opinion. So I've spoken to a lot of psychiatrists in the UK and the States to get their opinion as much as possible for free, which is a bit of a liberty, because many of them said, well, I can analyze the whole case and do a report for you, and it'll be about, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50K. And you go, right, I don't have that money, so I appreciate your input. Then you get, you know, you ring the next psychiatrist on your list to try and get a bit of advice, a bit more information.
A bit of knowledge, yeah.
And then you want it to be sort of unbiased. And I think the world of psychiatry in Ireland is fairly small, and they all seem to know each other. And I sought advice outside of that.
So that's what's going on between the night of the tragedy till her trial.
Oh, sorry, I knew nothing. I had a couple of meetings with the DPP who had told me sort of the way that the trial would go.
Yeah.
They had told me there was two medical experts who had deemed it to be insanity. So that's what I thought it was. I would disagree with both medical experts, some aspects of what the medical experts have said now that I have more information. But yeah, it wasn't until after the trial that I got access to the notes and put everything together. And you just feel like, why were certain decisions made? And they don't make sense when I sort of think through, we've children first legislation, so why were the children not put first? And one of the first lines in the children first guidelines is that the primary responsibility of a parent is the care and protection of their children. So how can clinicians who are talking to a patient who is saying that they don't feel safe around their children, that they don't want to be around their children, how can clinicians still believe that that patient can keep their primary responsibility to their children. It's illogical. It does not make sense. But as I sit here now, nobody has explained to me why they made those decisions.
You're perfectly right, what you're saying. It makes absolutely no sense. Why do you feel that the children's force legislation, force right, wasn't put a hand there? Like, why do you think the clinician didn't?
I honestly don't know. I mean, there's been talk about patient confidentiality, but I would believe that when decisions about a patient will impact on other people other than the patient, you can't use patient confidentiality. And if you think that there wasn't an impact on Conor Darren Carla, I'll show you their gravestone. That's how straightforward it is. I feel that patient confidentiality is being used sometimes as a get-out clause. I support patient confidentiality. However, if decisions are being made about a patient that are going to impact somebody else, you can't say, oh, patient confidentiality.
That subsides that then, yeah.
I think so.
Yeah. So you're campaigning for change to the legislation.
See, I'll be quite honest, it's not necessarily legislation. This is process.
Yeah.
So patient confidentiality can be breached if a clinician thinks that the patient is a danger to themselves or a danger to others. So they can breach. Now, the opinion, what is danger to themselves, what is danger to another?
Yeah.
It's a bit of a grey area. So I think it needs to be clearly defined. But I think a parent saying that they don't feel safe around their children and that patient having a suicidal ideation,
that warrants a breach.
That's, for me, is a massive big red flag when you put those two together. I try to stay impartial as I can, but when I read, I go, I would have raised a flag. At the first mention, I definitely would have consulted with colleagues to say, a patient has mentioned this to me. At the second mention, bang, children first. We need to protect those children. That would have been my interpretation of it. And to know that then there was multiple other entries in the medical notes, that we heard about at the trial, about not feeling safe around her children, not wanting to be around her children. One you might think should have been enough for had to have a serious conversation. A second mention should have been children first and protect the children.
You've mentioned to us, we had a chat before we start recording. You said you have some concerns with the term capacity in the law. Can you elaborate on that a bit for people who wouldn't be familiar with the term?
Yeah, so capacity is the ability of somebody to understand instruction. The simple, I suppose, explanation of capacity is the ability of somebody to understand instruction and to be able to give instruction. But that's well and fine. And we're having a chat here and I'm looking at you guys. I'm going, these two fellas seem to have capacity. But with regards to a patient who's been treated for their mental health, if they're in treatment for their mental health and they're being prescribed medication for their mental health, and this is not anti-pharmaceutical by any means. I'm very much pro. If there's something wrong with you, you know, you'll take pharmaceuticals. But I think when you're being prescribed pharmaceuticals that by their very nature, because they're treating mental health conditions, are altering the state of your mind. I think you cannot declare that a patient has capacity. I think you can declare that they have capacity, but it is being supported. And I think there needs to be a clear definition between, or a clarity between, those two occasions. And it may come down to the potency of the pharmaceutical being prescribed. But I would say that having spent 18 years of my life with Deirdre Morley, she was deemed to have capacity to stand trial. But being in that courtroom that day, I would say no, that Deirdre Morley did not have capacity. But I would be aware that she was probably on medication to support that capacity. I just do not feel that that's right. And it seems to be, to me, somewhat of an opportunity for clinicians to remove themselves from accountability and responsibility by declaring capacity, whilst at the same time prescribing mind-altering medication or medication that is altering the conditions of a person's mind. It's not logical to me.
Yeah, contradictory. Yeah. You said you knew Deirdre for 18 years, and obviously she had her struggles with mental health. But one thing you mentioned to us was that you seen an uptake in her form and her mood.
About a month before the children died, at the same time when clinicians were talking about should Deirdre be readmitted on a full-time basis, we were seeing, I suppose, the masking. And Deirdre was talking about returning to work. We talked about she wanted to kind of stay off. This would have been late December, early January. Talking about staying off till Easter, so that we could go away. Maybe we go up to Donegal for Easter. And then we were actually talking about holidays in May before the school term, taking the kids out of school to go away somewhere. So I was, yeah, it was positive. It's only now that I know that apparently people who make peace with their decision to take their own life, they have an uplift in spirit, or they appear to be more positive because they've made peace with that decision. Maybe that's what we were seeing. I don't know, but it would make sense. I mean, I remember I had a conversation with a woman who remembers dancing with her son in the kitchen of their house to Diana Ross. She even remembers the CD, dancing with her son in the kitchen. And then later, he was found to have taken his own life out in the garage, out in the shed. It doesn't make sense to me. Why wouldn't clinicians who know that a patient has suicidal ideation, why would they not give that advice or make that advice? I only know that advice after my children have died, or after Deirdre had made an attempt on her own life. It's still a stigma around, I think, around mental health. And I suppose there's a lot more open conversations, but I think we're still only scratching the surface. And whilst we still, in a way, and I hate using the word hide behind patient confidentiality and hide behind capacity, I think it's only through family engagement and family involvement. And in our case, I think the family dynamic, if a patient is in treatment for 1 hour with a clinician, the rest of the people in the family who spend the other 167 hours with the patient, they're better placed to know exactly what's happening. Just the process. So it's not the legislation as such. It's the process of understanding and the process of ensuring that everybody can support the patient, because we all want to support the patient. And I remember I'd spoken to Mental Health Reform, and Mental Health Reform is an advocacy group. And it's made up of about 80-odd advocacy groups, and they're all looking for change, different change, and different specialist sort of areas of mental health. And I went to an engagement session with them, and it was made up of, there was two directors from the HSE there. There was clinicians, there was HSE social workers, and there was patients, and there was families of patients. And it went on for a few hours, but I'll never forget, the two directors both left after about an hour, hour and a half. And that kind of struck me as, this isn't going to change. And part of the day was into groups to see, you know, how could families be supported better? How could patients be supported better? And I remember I was at a table with two social workers, and they spoke about how they run off their feet and how busy they are. I said, give me an example of what you're doing. What has you so busy? And they go, oh, well, you could get a patient who comes in and they've run out of credit on their phone and we have to go. And I'm going, well, sure, a family member could do that, or a friend could do that. Or somebody's been brought in and they missed the rent and the rent is due and the landlord is, you know, threatening this. I'm thinking, well, a family could take care of that, or a friend could sort of sort that out until the patient is released and gets back on track. And I honestly sat listening to them thinking, 70 or 80% of what they're doing, what's keeping them so busy, taking them away from really what they should be doing, could be done by family members, friends. So I think the family engagement part of the mental health treatment plan is vital. But I do think that if you're just engaging with family members who aren't part of the family dynamic, then they will not know exactly what is happening within the family dynamic. And they will only be reiterating to clinicians what they're hearing from the patient.
Yeah.
Because if you're engaging only with family members who are not part of the household and they're not speaking to the co-parent or the children in any detailed way about what's happening, then they're of no use to clinicians, I feel. So it's not legislation that has to be changed. It's not the Mental Health Act that has to be changed. It's just the way that we treat patients, that we treat co-parents, and we treat their families.
You spoke that what happened to Una in 2010 and how she has been made promises by political figures. Have you had any support or promises from anyone politically?
I won't say, but promises, maybe there's been commitments made.
Yeah.
Whether you want to call that a promise or not, that's up for your listeners to think of themselves. But certainly when somebody puts in a letter to Una Butler, I'm committed to doing this, I take it that he's, you know, that is a promise. I've spoken to Mary Butler, who's the Minister for Mental Health. I wish I could have that conversation again. I've had help from Mark Ward, who is my local TD. He's the Sinn Féin Minister for Mental Health. He brought me in to meet Francis Black, who's a senator. We had a lot of good conversations, but it just seems to stall in the, I think there's a mental health committee. I mean, there's proposals for change that have been sitting there since 2015, 2016. That's 8 years ago. And it still hasn't managed to get through committee and into the Dáil. And whether they're trying to look at too big of a chunk, maybe they need to break it down and look at different areas of it, I don't know. I've also had help and support from Emer Higgins, who is the Fine Gael TD in my area. She wrote to Mary Butler on my behalf. The response she got back was it had two different type fonts and different type sizes. So it would suggest that it was a copy and paste. They didn't even have the respect or the courtesy to paste as plain text. So it just seems to be, yeah, give them that and that'll keep them happy. So I've had support, but it just doesn't seem to be going anywhere. And I don't understand why. Sometimes I think, is it too much of a hot topic? Is the death of children, is it maybe there's not enough votes and the death of, on average, statistically, maybe two children a year? I don't understand why when myself and Una Butler are saying exactly the same thing, how our children would be alive today if certain processes and certain decisions were different. I don't understand why it hasn't changed. I really don't. And I don't know who can get behind it or who wants to get behind it. Sometimes I think that our political system isn't right, that people are in for 5 years and they're just looking at, do I need to deal with this? Now I can let it go for 5 years, you know, and let the next person deal with it.
It would almost make a question, I don't know how dark it might sound, but how many children per year would it need for them to finally go, this is what they've been fighting for and this is what we need to change?
Well, when you look at road deaths, and I have anybody who has experienced a loved one dying in a road death, I mean, I can, they have my deepest condolences and my deepest sympathies because I know what it's like to say, kiss somebody and say, I'll see you tomorrow and never see them again. So I know that experience that a lot of relatives of road death victims encounter. But there's over 200, I think, road deaths a year. And with that comes safety campaigns, comes speed limits, become Garda checks. There's so much put behind because we're chatting earlier, one death in anything is one death too many. But given the volume of deaths around roads, we look and we put as many fail safes in as we can in relation to speed checks and limits and, you know, all the safety aspects that come with that. And you think, you know, two children. Why can't they put the checks in to try and save two lives? In my case, three lives. Why aren't those checks there? And you think they are there with Children First legislation. You would think that they are there with the red flags that I see within what I heard at the trial that had been discussed between Deirdre and her clinicians. And as I sit here now, I still 4 years after they died and I still don't have a lot of those answers.
It's like we were chatting earlier on. And I was even stating that I thought, like, next of kin, that alone would have warranted a clinician reaching out and explaining somebody's suicidal ideation or somebody's thoughts that could harm somebody in their family or anything like that.
Next of kin doesn't really mean anything. I believe I was listed in next of kin.
Next of kin literally just means they'll, what, like that, that actually has nothing, does it? They literally just ring you.
I don't think it has any legal obligation.
I don't believe so.
I think it's just an emergency contact.
Hit the floor in the hospital, that's just someone. But I thought that would have warranted that, let alone what you're fighting for, like the co-parenting, for somebody to go in and make it so clear.
I think, as I say, I will stand over patient confidentiality. Yeah. I believe in patient confidentiality. But once decisions are being made that will impact other people, then patient confidentiality has to go out the window. You can't stand behind it.
Mm. We asked you there, did you have any support politically about this and the campaign that you're leading? But did you have any support in the aftermath of what happened?
Politically or
mentally?
No. Other than through charities. I mean, I can't speak highly enough of the Gardaí who gave me the literature. Just basically, here's what we have about people who can counsel you and support you. But I remember reading the familicide report that came out last year, and it talks about in the aftermath of a familicide that the NEPS team goes into the schools and anywhere that there's children involved. And again, I can't speak highly enough of the Department of Education, their NEPS team, because they went into Skull Cronon where the two boys were and they approached the creche to see if they needed support. And they helped out with Rathcool where the boys played. But the Familicide report outlines that, I don't think it clearly says who reaches out, but it says within the first 24 hours, we reach out to the family for whether they need support. Mm. That didn't happen with me. And then at the next section, is it within the first week, we continue that support and we continue that help. First week, I was only speaking to the Gardaí, my family and friends and the Undertaker. And then the next one is ongoing after that. The first time anybody offered me any support, other than the support I sought myself through charities like First Light were fantastic, Anam Cara were fantastic. But they're charities, it shouldn't be their task to support the light. And I remember there was a familicide occurrence in, I think it was Cork, Kerry, in the Sullivan family. And they said the same thing. There was zero support given to them or anybody in the community. And it's funny, I was only chatting to somebody recently about this, actually on Sunday. You just don't realise who is impacted. Because I remember I was determined to go back to their school, to go back to the creche. I didn't want there to be anywhere where I felt I couldn't go because of, you know, it would bring up memories of Conor, Darren, Carla. So one of the first places I did go, I remember I went shopping over in Dunn Stores. Hopefully they'll give me a donation to the charity for plugging Dunn Stores. If you're listening, Dunn Stores. I went back over to Dunn Stores shopping because that's where I used to bring the kids to do the Friday big shop. I come around one of the aisles and who's there but Connor's football coach. And sure, he sees me, I see him, we both burst into tears. And but I'm glad I went and I still go over there shopping. But I went into the Tesco that's across the road from Skull Cronon where the lads went. And that was the last place that Connor was seen. And I went in and I'll never forget and I never thought about it until I was actually in there. And there's a guy who works in there. And if he ever gets to hear this, I'm so sorry if I upset him. But he saw me. I'll never forget his face. And he just shot out from behind the counter, just out into the back room. He was gone. And I'm standing at the counter with me few bits and pieces. Going, where's your man gone? But it wasn't until I realised then afterwards, I'd been told by the Gardaí that Conor was last seen, because they were going tracing back through the timeline. He was last seen in Tesco. It wasn't until I saw the CCTV footage from Tesco that I realised that that was the guy who had served Conor, and he must have known that. And then he sees me and he just, bang, he was gone.
Brings it back for him as well.
Brought it back for him. And I didn't realise that. Like, you know, what do you call her? The lollipop lady who used to put the kids across. You know, it's their friends. I think about their friends and our childminder more than anybody else. Mm. I really do. I just think because there's, you can register to be a victim. And I've had a discussion recently with Minister Helen McAtee, and she sent me a response, which I don't agree with because I think she's been ill-informed from the victim liaison in the HSE. And it's not for me. I think victim support, you don't realise how many victims there are. For the anniversary of the kids in January, I only heard that on that day that some of Connor's friends were going to go over, they were going to walk over. And I thought, that's fantastic of them. And so I reached out to one of the parents and said, do you think, you know, if I went up, would they like to, you know, to have a chat? And I'll never forget, and I got chatting to them, and it was only then chatting to them I realised that there was one or two of them who go over like on a monthly basis. I didn't realise that. I just got me that the amount of people who have just been, like I do know that some of his friends, I think two of Connor's friends and one of Dara's friends had extended counselling because of what happened. And I have massive guilt over how our tragedy has impacted other kids. And I had a conversation only recently, and again, it's 4 years, the conversation that one of those parents had with their kid. And she was just saying he couldn't believe it. And he kept thinking, he kept going, coming back into his parents going, are you sure it's not dad's friend, Dara? It's not my friend that's died. And Jesus Christ, my heart broke thinking of him just being so confused by that, you know? You just don't realise the impact. And I'll fight for that change because I just don't want anybody else impacted in the way that I have been. I'll never forget my poor mother at the funeral because, as I said earlier, she was in the early stages of dementia. And in one way, maybe it was a good thing because I don't think she realised half the time what was going on or what had happened. My sister, my brothers, my friends, but mostly I think about our childminder, all their friends, you know, your man in Tesco, the lollipop lady, the football coaches. You just do not realise how far reaching it goes. And yeah, that it could have been avoided, I feel.
Tragedies like that can affect whole communities.
Yeah.
You know, whole communities can be affected by it. Simon Harris is probably going to be made Taoiseach later this week. Did you ever have any interactions with him when he was the Minister for Health?
No. Una Butler did whilst he was, I think, standing in for Helen McEntee as Minister for Justice. And he wrote to Una and he made a number of commitments, which I believe still have to come to fruition. So I'm hoping that he'll treat the Irish people a little bit better than what he's treated Una Butler. Maybe he's in the process of trying to keep those commitments, but I feel that they should have happened sooner. So hopefully he'll keep his word to a grieving mother and he'll keep his commitments in the letter that he wrote to her.
Have you any intentions on reaching out to him now that he's going to be Taoiseach?
I feel that I'm nearly better off doing the likes of this. Carry on talking to anybody who'll listen to me, to be quite honest with you. And if one of them picks up on what I'm saying and feels that, you know something, we do need to make a change. If we can prevent 2 deaths a year, then we should be doing that. Then the onus is on them. I mean, why should I have to go chasing politicians to make these changes? Why should I have to go chasing the HSE to make changes? Why should I have to go chasing St. Patrick's Mental Health Services to make changes? Surely from speaking to the likes of myself and Una, they should realise we could have saved these children. So let's make change in our processes and procedures that will save other children and will save you having somebody else on here in the future snotting all over the place chatting about their kids. Why should I go chasing? If he wants to know about how he can save children, I'm on social media as Connor's Clips. My address has been in the paper. I know that some government ministers have my telephone number. I'm readily available. I'll chat to whoever. I'm just sick of chasing people, to be quite honest. I feel I've been banging my head against the wall and quite honestly, it's beginning to hurt. But I'll carry on banging my head against the wall. And if he has any respect for the memory of my children, or any of them have any respect for the memory of my children, I'm talking about the HSE, St. Pat's, the Department of Health, anybody who feels, yeah, we should make this change, then they know where to find me. It's up to them to feel that they feel 2 lives a year are worth saving, not for me to go chasing people. Yeah.
It's tough to be able to sit here and listen to how clear you're making these statements. These statistics, you're saying 2 children a year. One child is too many in anyways.
Yeah.
You're saying 2 children a year. And you're saying, you're coming with some great points and arguments. I don't see how somebody hasn't just reached out and somebody hasn't tried harder to make this change. I think everything you've said has been made so clear.
Well, I tell you what, you've had a guest on this show in Micheál Martin. If you've still got his telephone number, you can give him a ring and say, listen, we've been chatting to this fella. You could really help him. And it would be great to think that Micheál Martin, after speaking to Una Butler, if he spoke to me, that he would take it on and he would support us in trying to make this change.
Yeah, well, look, we know they are listening. We know that politicians are listening and we'll do our best as well to help you with this. And that's, of course, what we want is in here today, Andrew, to get your story out there and hopefully make change. And like I said, we'll do whatever we can to support you, and we know that they are listening, so let's hope that something happens.
You said that you're going to keep talking and you'll keep putting the story out there. Have you had many opportunities to do anything like this?
I've been on the likes of Matt Cooper and the like. I had been invited on the Ray Darcy show with RTE, but that was pulled. I think that was after I was supposed to be on with the Late Late Show back in, I think it was October 2021, I think it was. But that got pulled. That was a difficult sort of period because they contacted me to see would I like to go on to the Late Late Show. And it wasn't about mental health. I was going to be chatting about the three projects that I was doing. And they had announced that I was going to be on. And we had sort of gone as far as, you know yourself, there's meetings that they prepare. I think you've both been on the Late Late Show. So you know the process. You get a call, you get talked through it, and then you do another call. And so I had three calls, and the final call was basically talking through, and it was going to be 8 to 9 minutes on As Dara Did, because Daniel O'Donnell was going to do a benefit concert for the charity for As Dara Did. So it's going to be 8 to 9 minutes on As Dara Did, 2 to 3 minutes on Connor's Clips, and 2 to 3 minutes on Snowman for Carla. And it even came down to the detail whether it would be Ryan Tuberty at the time or me that would announce that it was Daniel O'Donnell who was doing the concert for us. And we rescheduled the raffle that we were doing to coincide with launching it for the Late Late Show, etc. And I got a phone call to say that they were going to postpone it because some members of the Morley family had said that they would be traumatized by hearing me or seeing me on the show talking about the kids. My conversation with RTE at the time was, well, you've prepped me to talk about the positive stuff. Ryan would probably, how are you and how are you getting on? And that would be a lead for me to say, oh, well, I'm concentrating on the projects and to launch straight into the projects. So there was nothing in my mind that was traumatic because I don't look at the project. For me, the projects are, for me, they're a lifesaver. They're a huge positive. I think more people now know about Conor, Dara and Carla and what, you know, kids they were through the projects I do than would probably have ever got to know about them. For me, they've given a life to the kids that the kids didn't get to lead. Mm. So for me, it was going to be a hugely positive thing. So they said they had to meet with the family, and I was out for lunch when I got the phone call on the following Tuesday to say that they were pulling the conversation because, and what I was told on the phone was that some people would find it traumatic and that RTE had been sued before and they were afraid of being sued. So I had to accept that. It was a blow because I think it would have been fantastic to launch the charity event on the Late Late Show. I mean, it has huge viewership, and to be able to talk about the projects that I do, I love talking about the projects. And so on the Friday when I was supposed to be on and the lineup was announced, a lot of the press picked up on that I wasn't on. So they contacted RTE, and RTE said it was due to the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland regulations, which forbid them from or restricted them from broadcasting traumatic content. And I'm reading this statement, I'm going, I was invited on to chat about a kids' YouTube channel, a kids' colouring competition, and a charity. And two, as I sit here now, 3 years later, and I've written to RTE, they have not explained how a kids' colouring competition and a kids' YouTube channel and a charity breaches the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland regulations. And yet, I remember there was on the Late Late Show, I think it could be a year ago or so, there was abuse allegations against a college in Ireland. And there was two of the survivors of that abuse were on the show. And I tuned in and I had to turn over. I found that just so traumatic thinking about them as kids. And I think I related it to my own kids.
Mm.
But I had the choice to turn over and I did. So I don't think it's traumatic content that they were worried about. I think it was about being sued.
Mm.
And I'd rather had they been honest with me. They were in the initial call, but then their statement to the public
changed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so if there's anybody who listens to this who works for the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland, can you please contact Talking Bollocks and explain how a kids' colouring competition, a kids' YouTube channel, and a charity would have breached the BAI codes?
I just can't even think about the benefits to the charity to the charities and the work you're doing, the benefits that you would have reaped from going on to the late late.
Oh, it's huge viewership. I mean, I remember we had rescheduled everything for the late late show. So we had launched and we were sitting at about 30 grand, which is massive money.
Mm.
But I had spoken to people who had launched their charities on the late late show and they were talking about figures of, you know, 200 grand, 300 grand, half a million. So we were hopeful. And Daniel, there was a Daniel O'Donnell special about 2 days before the raffle closed. And he mentioned us on the Late Late Show for, I think it was about 5-6 seconds, saying, oh, I'm doing this in a benefit concert. And you can find out more details on esdaradid.ie. And in the space of the 2 or 3 days, we'd got up to 100 grand. So to have been able to go on. But yeah, it's more the, if you're afraid of being sued, just come out and say you're afraid of being sued.
Mm. Have a
don't
about you, yeah.
Hide behind BAI codes, because the content that I was going to talk about wouldn't have breached BAI codes.
But again, like you said there, the benefits to that would have been absolutely huge for the charities and stuff. And like you said, in less than 10 seconds, there was 70,000 profit. Imagine if you got 8 or 9 minutes there alone.
Ah, yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's funny then that I'd been asked by the Ray Darcy show to chat about mental health. And then I was told, no, we don't want you anymore. And then I remember Dara's birthday. I'd put on Connor's clips on the social media about mental health, because it's not ideally what I want to use Connor's clips for, but I have a platform of followers on that. So I use it sometimes for campaigning. And I remember I did a tweet about mental health in conjunction with Dara's birthday. And every single media outlet contacted me to talk further about it, other than RTE, who contacted Una Butler for her comment. And then when the inquest opened in July, I think it was June or July when it reopened, it recommenced, it was in every media outlet other than RTE. And I just felt, sometimes you just feel that maybe as our national broadcaster, whether they're being too cautious in relation to our tragedy, I don't know. But certainly I could do with their support. I could do with everybody's support. And that's why I was conflicted, no doubt. I mean, the first invitation to appear came into me about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, and I couldn't reconcile talking bollocks with me talking about my children.
Yeah.
But any opportunity now to talk about trying to make change and trying to advocate for change, I'll take it. And hopefully somebody who can make that change will hear it and decide, yeah, they do want to support us.
Yeah, I didn't want to talk about that here, but that's something that myself and Terrence were discussing over the weekend about how we tried to make this happen 2 years ago. For one reason or another, it didn't. And the two of us both agreed that that was the biggest regret we've ever had since starting the podcast, regardless of who the guests were. And as you said, we've had Micheál Martin, we've had some very impactful guests, some really compelling stories being told here on this podcast. And that was the one moment we always looked back on and said, I wish we could have got that across the line. So I'm so glad that we were able to do it now. And Tarnan said earlier, he commends you for coming in and that you stuck for words. I'm in the exact same position. I'm literally in awe of you sitting there, Andrew. I don't know, like, as a father myself, I'd even like speaking of something happening to my daughter. And, like, I'm struggling even to put into words, even how to ask this question. But, like, how you're sitting here in front of us, I can't get my head around it. I can't even get the question out. Like, how have you done it? What? Like, how did you deal with the grief?
Connor's clips, as Dara did, slow-mo for Carla. That keeps me going. And as I said to you, standing outside literally hours after holding his body in my arms, begging for life, begging for a sign of life, all I could think of was, I never got to keep my promise to set up a YouTube channel for him. And it was going to be comedy clips. So we talked about what he was going to put on it. And I still have the notepad at home where we started writing ideas. So I said to him, right, if we're going to do this, you know, we'll do it as a family. So everybody was going to be involved. And I said, we need to build up a bank of about 20 ideas. And then we'll start filming, and then we'll upload the first one, and then we'll carry on writing, and we'll film, and we'll upload, and we've got one up a week, but we need to build up a bank of ideas first. And I still have the notepad where we were writing down ideas, and there was one that he had about, and it's in his handwriting. He had lovely handwriting, fair play to him. And it was, it's weird, the stuff you remember about your kids, like, you know, he's lovely handwriting. One was Deirdre was going to be at the bottom of the stairs and shout up, right, breakfast is ready. I've laid your clothes out in their beds. Come on, get changed, come down. And Connor was going to come down in one of my suits and I was going to squeeze into whatever size clothes I could fit into and write down. And she would go, wrong beds or wrong clothes or whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was just going to be silly little things like that. Mm-hmm. And that's what we were going to do. But we never got around to filming the first one. We were still building up the ideas. So for me, then Connor's clips was the videos that I have of the kids. And I look back in some of the videos, and particularly to have found that Lego movie one, sorry, movie with Lego, was just, yeah, man. I've watched it a good few times now, and you're just going, their imaginations were just amazing. And I'll never forget Connor. I think he was about one. And you want to develop your kids' imaginations. And I'll never forget, I was in bed and he'd come into the bed and you're going, oh, you're playing. And then you're going, he's not quite getting what I'm, his imagination hasn't developed yet. So I remember pulling the sheet up over the two of us and saying, oh, we're now in a cave. And we're in a big cave, because he would have known the cave from the Gruffalo. I don't know, do you know the Gruffalo? But there's a cave in that. And so we're in the cave and the Gruffalo is outside. Can you hear the Gruffalo? And I go, rawr. And he would go, because he knew it was me. But then I have to say, I think it sparked his imagination. And then when I see the stuff that he did after that in his homemade comics, I'll never forget finding one of his comics, and it was Super Gran and Super Grandad. And Super Gran and Super Grandad go and get married in Dundalk. And I'm thinking, I know for a fact that the kids have never been in Dundalk. So how has he written that Super Gran and Super Grandad are getting married in Dundalk? And then I was trying to piece it together. I used to, in part of my job, I used to look after a contract that was based in Dundalk, and Connor was an early riser and he used to be down. And I remember one morning him saying to me, where are you going? And I remember saying, I'm going to Dundalk. But then what I think it was we had season tickets for Ireland for the FAI matches. And as part of that, we got tickets to the FAI Cup final. And it would have had to be in, I think, 2019 or 2018. It was Cork against Dundalk. And where we were sitting was in the Aviva. So Aviva need to donate to the charity as well, seeing I'm mentioning Aviva. But that part, the low part.
The low stand.
Yeah, and that's where the Dundalk fans were. Mm. And they set off all their flares to the extent all you could see was a red glow. And I remember the two lads just looking, going, they thought the place was on fire. And so maybe that's why they thought Dundalk was just a fabulous place and that it's lit up like, with flares. I don't know, but I just think, that sparked his imagination. And that's what, you see on Connor's clips then, that Carla really believing that she was a fairy and changing the lads into frogs and monkeys. And so, yeah. So I'm sitting here because of those projects.
Yeah.
And you can see, like, I'm chatting about the night in question. I'm in bits. Chatting about the projects.
You're still able to smile and laugh.
Listen, I have a couple of mantras. Kids wouldn't want me to be angry.
Mm.
Kids wouldn't want me to be sad.
Mm.
And it's hard. And I do get angry. I do get sad. But I just know they wouldn't want me that way. And that drives me on. And also trying to make change drives me on. I couldn't live with myself if I didn't try to make this change.
Yeah.
You know?
Andrew, how's your head now? You share and you talk about helping everybody else, about the charity walk and what you're doing here and how you feel towards people who are connected to the kids and everybody else. How are you, like?
Well, as I said to you earlier on, I was at rock bottom. So the only way is up from there. Sometimes people ask me, "Why I'm still living in the house, and despite what happened there, there's still, everywhere I look, there's just great memories of the kids there." But that may change. I'm going through a divorce process, so I may have to sell the house to satisfy divorce. So that may change, and I'll have to deal with that. And you end up rolling with the punches. I was hopeful for the HSE review when it came out. I was just so disappointed with it. It drives you back down. But, I've so much to live for. I feel like don't get me wrong, there's been some very dark, dark moments and dark times. There's been moments where you're in a dark place. But then I just think about, the walk that's coming up, the next Snowman for Carla competition. What am I going to post for Connor's clips tomorrow? Maybe next week that I'm going to visit one of the projects that we've helped and to be able to see the happiness and joy that the charity has done. It lifts you again. If I got a phone call from Simon Harris or Micheál Martin or Mary Butler or whoever else to say that they're going to make a change and help make change and that they've seen the light, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. But I intend to live a very long life. campaigning and doing what I'm doing with the three projects. So
hopefully there is a long life, but hopefully you don't have to keep campaigning too long. Your kids' memories live through you as well. That's the thing, you know. Did I hear that you went to see a medium before?
Yeah. Asked me 5 years ago, would I go to a medium? I would have just laughed out of the room. I'm a very practical person. I'm a very logical. I think you can, you know, chatting to me about legislation, everything else, I break it down, I deconstruct it and analyze it. It was funny because it's quite a long story. So I'll try and make a long story short, but it'll still be long. I was getting pains across my shoulders and I went to my GP and he was saying, that's grief. Your body closes in to protect your heart. I didn't know this. So your body knows that something's wrong. Doesn't know what it is because it doesn't understand what had happened to me. So your body is closed in to protect your heart. That's the natural inclination. So if somebody gives you a fright, you automatically close in like that. And seemingly that's what that reaction is. Whether that's right or not, you might get people saying, oh, that's a load of BS. But that's what he's telling me. So he says, go and get there's healing massages there. So you can go and get a massage. So I booked in to get a massage and I went to, I Googled healing massages and there was a place quite near me and sure, I'll give her a shout out. Oh God, I'd love to give her a shout out. Forget her first name. It was the Healing Hut in Selbridge anyway. Grace in the Healing Hut. And so I said to her, listen, I better tell you who I am and this, that and the other. So I went to Grace, but Grace does other stuff like Reiki and crystals and all of this stuff. I said, no, just sort out my shoulders and me back. So while she was doing that, it was quite funny because she was getting a sense because of her Reiki experience and everything else. But the second COVID, I think, lockdown happened and she had rang me to cancel the next appointment. She said, do you want to do distance healing? I said, what in the name of Jesus is distance healing? I'm like, what's that about? And she goes, well, you're in your house. I'm in my studio and I do healing like a kind of a Reiki or whatever it is by distance. I'm like, you're planning on charging me for this? And she goes, no. I says, oh, we'll do it then. So we'll give it a go. So she had sent me a link for a YouTube. She says, right, 10 o'clock, curtains closed, TV off, any electronic. She says, I'll send it to you, but if you can close down the lid of the laptop, but you just listen to the music, but keep your eyes shut. So I says, yeah, grand, I'll do that. So lay down, and she said, have a blanket over you because you'll get cold just lying there, lying still. So I said, this is great. I'm lying on the sofa 10 o'clock in the morning with a blanket over me. So 10 o'clock, press play. And when I close my eyes, I do now, I see a circle. And I always thought it was a reflection of my pupil. And when I chat to people about it, when they close their eyes, it takes a few seconds to kick in. Some people see stripes, some people see multiple circles and all of this. And I know this because if the kids woke up at night and you'd go in and it could be 4 o'clock in the morning, you get back into bed and your alarm is going to go off in an hour and you think, oh, gee, you know, you close your eyes and I'd see a circle. But it was always black and white. So I press play and I lie down and close my eyes and I see the circle. But next thing, it starts changing shape. And it started, what color was first? I think it was blue. And it was, the way I can describe it is like a lava lamp. So there was three or four dark blues and three or four light blues sort of moving. And I'm lying there going, ah, no, what's this? And I was pinching myself. And I'm going, I can feel that. So, and I was trying desperately to keep my eyes shut because that was the main thing she told me. And I'm going, I know for it. Like, this is mad. And this color, and it was a very, and I remember the color because I was going, I have a t-shirt that color. The light blue was kind of like a diesel, kind of a light diesel blue. I thought it was odd as bejesus. And then it started going purple and it was light purple and dark purple. And then finally it ended up light green and dark green. And it was gorgeous. It was like, this is mad. And I kept thinking, I'm not on any medication. I wasn't taking any medication. I'm awake. That's YouTube. So it's not like she sent me some hypnotic tune or something. And I just couldn't figure it out. And I kind of thought, oh, it must be nearly 11 o'clock now. And I remember opening my eyes, lifting the laptop and seeing down the corner, it was 10 to 11. And I lay back, another 10 minutes, lay back down, close my eyes, black and white circles. So whatever it was that was happening was gone. So 11 o'clock, she sent me a text and goes, you free for a call? And she was chatting to me and she goes, what did you think of that? And I was, oh yeah, that was very relaxing. Sure, I was lying there with a blanket over me. Sure, it was lovely. She goes, did you see anything? And me being me, I was like, well, like what? She goes, colours. I says, maybe. And she goes, did you see blue? Yeah, maybe. And she then started to explain what Blue was, and it was about communication and speaking and everything like that. And she goes, you're very good at that, and that's what you should make your future, speaking or writing or whatever else. And so I went, okay, that's great. And then she said, did you see purple? I'm like, oh, here, hold on. And she goes, purple is the color of love in the chakras or something. And if you're chatting about from a position of love, so if you're chatting about the kids and this, that, and the other, and it's from, you're very good at that. And I'm kind of thinking, this is all about, you know. And then she says, green. I missed out a bit of the story. When she was giving me the massage a few weeks previously, she says, is there something up with your stomach? And I says, no, there's nothing wrong with my stomach at all. Like, I'm eating and everything like this. So she says, did you see green? And she says, green is the color of the Archangel Raphael, I think it is. Oh my God, don't start talking to me about angels. I don't need this. And she says, do you remember when I chatted to you about your stomach? She says, I still got that sense that something was wrong. So I asked the Archangel Raphael for help. And he says, you're very apprehensive about your future. And that kind of was the first thing that kind of struck a chord to me, because I thought, she knows I'm a talker and she knows that I love the kids. But this whole thing about, I'd only had a conversation that week with my brother and my sister going, I feel that I've changed as a person and I can't go back to doing the job that I did with Sodexo, who still employ me. And I haven't gone back, and I just feel that the job I used to do, I could never do again. I've just changed. My whole perspective on life has changed and everything has changed. And I'd had that conversation and I thought, yeah, I'd had a knot in my stomach about what does my future hold and what am I going to do? So that was the first thing that kind of struck me. And then she said, oh, I have the chakra cards, and I picked one out, and it's the winged horse. And the winged horse is, you need to make a change. You need to do something. You're dying to do something else, and you need to do something else. And you need to take the leap. You have to take a leap of faith, and your winged horse is going to catch you, and you'll fly. So maybe me, I'm telling all my friends about this, that I have a winged horse now. That, and I nicknamed the winged horse Wubba, because Carla's first word was Wubba. She would point and she'd go, Wubba, and that cup is Wubba, and everything was Wubba. So Wubba the winged horse. So that was Wubba the winged horse. And then when I was telling people this story, they'd go, wow, would you think of going to a medium? And I said, nah, not at all. It was just, you know. And then I thought, do you know, why not? Let's go and see, you know. So I got recommended Carol down in Enniscorthy. And me being me, I changed my voicemail so she wouldn't. It used to be my voicemail was, you're true, the voicemail of Andrew McGinley from Sodexo. So I changed, you're true to Andrew, leave a message.
Yeah.
And I rang her. And I forget, it was a Monday and it was in the afternoon. And so I rang her and got through. She answered and I said, how you doing? Looking to make a booking to come down to see you. And there was silence to the extent I thought, you know, kind of looking at my phone, that's still connected. And so eventually I go, hello, are you there? And she goes, yeah, I'm still here. Can you come down to me next Monday? And people had told me Carol's usually booked up for like 6 months or a year because a good medium is hard to find and they're usually booked up. So I was ringing, and this was, I think it was October, November, thinking that it'll be the summer before I'd see her. And I'm going, next Monday? Okay, yeah, we can do that. And she goes, I have a feeling I need to speak to you with some urgency. I go, oh, geez, right, fair enough. So I go down and I brought one of my neighbours with me who knew where Carol lived. She was one of the people that recommended Carol. And she says, I can be quite emotional. And I says, well, if I'm too emotional to drive, you can drive back. So down to Carol and I go in and I sit down and Carol talks about what's going to happen. And we're a bit like this. So she's across the room from me and she puts on her glasses and she has a notepad because she writes down keywords and she looks at me. And next thing she's drawn back in her chair and she's looking at me. And next thing she's looking all around me and I'm sitting with me back to a wall. And I'm going like, what's she looking at? What's going on? And she says, you have an army of spirits with you. And I'm going, yeah. But she says this to everybody. And then she started naming people. And my sister Michelle had just done the family tree on the McGinley side. And there's a whole lot of names that I was recognising. And Michelle's husband had died a few years back and he came through and just heard. And you're sitting there going, where are they? Because she's still, it was a mad experience. And then I started going, okay. And she goes, who would you like to speak to? And I'm convinced she didn't know who I was. But later on when Carla showed up, she turned around and she goes, you're your man with the three kids, aren't you? So I thought to myself, who do I want to speak to? And I thought, I might get a bit of sense out of Connor. Connor was 9. Yeah, sensible kind of a kid. I'll get a bit of sense out of Connor. So I said, Connor. And she looks at me and she's kind of tilts her head a bit like she's listening to somebody. And I go, this is quite an act now, this is. And then she looks at me and she goes, Connor says he wants you to take his white football boots out of the wardrobe and put them out beside Dara's shoes. Connor had white hand-me-down football boots. I hadn't told her Dara's name. I had Dara's shoes out on a chest of drawers because there were black and blue runners that he used to wear everywhere. And when he was going to birthday parties and stuff, I'd clean them and I'd get a Sharpie and I'd colour in the black felt. So they looked like new from a distance. They looked pristine. And they meant a lot to me because I'd done that about 30 or 40 times. And I had them sitting up on the chest of drawers beside some other stuff. But I had Connor's football boots, his shin pads and his jerseys and everything in the wardrobe. If I was to ask you to guess what colour boots kids wear, chances are you'd say black.
Yeah.
Or you'd go, oh, they wear those luminous colours. And the last colour you'd say is white. And the only reason he had white was they were hand-me-down from one of his older cousins. So that got me. I was like, I know for a fact this woman hasn't been in my bedroom and been through me wardrobe. So that got me, right? That's... And then she told me stuff about the night they died that only me and the Gardaí know. And then she says, there's another child here. And I said, oh, that would be Dara. You mentioned about his shoes. And she told me a secret that Dara had told me about 2 weeks before he died, word for word. And it was a secret that I thought it was encountering a bit of a problem. And I thought, I'll help him with this. There's no point in telling Deirdre about it or anybody else. I'll sort this out for him. So only me and Dara would know. And she was out telling me that word for word. And I could give you any amount of guesses and you wouldn't. So then I'm thinking, how? She'd only know that from Dara. And then eventually she was like, Carla. And she said, oh, there's a girl here too. They have a girl with it. And then eventually that's when she went, oh, geez, you're the guy with the three kids. And it was like, she says, have you got a brown sofa? And I was giving her nothing. I was just kind of looking at her, keeping a straight face. And I'm just looking at her and I'm not nodding. I'm not shaking my head, nothing. And she goes, oh, it's actually dark brown on the bottom, but it's got beige cushions. That's my sofa to a dark brown beige cushion. And she goes, the kids tell me that you moved it, but you moved it back and they don't want you to move it again. And the sofa itself is in three sections and it was all along one wall. But when people would come to visit me, we were kind of all sitting in a row. So I thought, do you know something? It's in three sections. I'll move it around and see, can I make it an L shape or whatever? But it just didn't suit the room. So I thought, I'll move it back and I'll just buy another chair for the other side of the room. And I just thought, how? I was there on my own when I did it. Now, you could guess that somebody had a brown sofa. Would you be able to guess that it was dark brown with beige cushions? I don't know. Could you guess that they moved it, but they moved it back? So there was too much out of it that got me thinking, no, the only people who know some of this stuff, like she said, Carla's so happy that you kept her doll, her black doll. And she had a black doll with black curly hair. And she says, oh, she's so happy that you kept her black doll with the black curly hair. Now, if I was to ask you, you have a daughter, did your daughter have dolls?
Yeah.
Chances are they were white dolls.
Yeah.
But she had this black doll. And you're just kind of thinking to yourself, there was too much through the whole thing that she could not guess, that she could not. So I was just, yeah, this kind of threw me. So she told me about 12 or 13 things that just she couldn't know, that nobody else could know. So we were leaving and I was driving up with my neighbour Linda and we're driving up, we're talking about what had happened. And we were driving up the N11 up towards the M50 and we were going to drive around the M50 and then back out to Newcastle. So I said, listen, we'll take a left here off the N11. We'll go and then we'll stick on Google Maps and we'll end up probably going over the Sally Gap and coming down into Britis and then Newcastle. So she goes, yeah, Grands. We're still chatting about, you know, the medium and what had come up. And at the end of the medium, goes, oh, the kids tell me you have a horse. And I go, I don't have a horse. And she's like this, she's tilting her head like she's listening to them. And she goes, no, the kids say you have a horse. And I'm thinking, I says, well, they had a sort of a rocking horse, but it was more a rocking reindeer. It had antlers for handlebars. And that's the only horse that, and she goes, no, kids say you have a horse. And I'm thinking, I used to bring the kids out to Leperstown once a year just to see, you know, that's the only connection. So we're driving down this road in the middle of Wicklow, trying to head over, take the back roads over to Newcastle. And we're going down this road and the trees are all covered in. Like it's one of those roads where the trees meet. It's like a tunnel.
Yeah. Mm.
But you could see that it opens out at the end. And we were getting down near the end and I was going, what was it about the horse? And then I went, Wubba, the winged horse. The kids are telling me that I've actually got Wubba, the winged horse. And Linda's in the passenger seat and she goes, horse. And we'd come out of the trees and she's pointing. I look at where she's pointing. And there's about a 10-foot tall wooden horse in a field in the middle of this field, in the middle of Wicklow. And I've gone back to see it since, and I might actually go back because I want to buy it off the dude if I ever moved house and I have room for it. And it was more or less, yeah, you've got a winged horse, take the leap, do what you're doing, do everything that you want to do. You've got a winged horse, so take the leap, you've got your winged horse. And I'll show you the photograph, taking the photograph of the winged horse, and I'll show you. And I, when the podcast comes out, I might put it on my social media, on Connor's Clips, so you can see what I'm chatting about. But I went back to her subsequently and she told me other stuff. So I've been back three times and the last time I went back was by accident. Somebody else asked me about making an appointment for them and I made the appointment and the night before they couldn't go. So I decided, it's been about a year since I went and I went back. But asked me 5 years ago, would I go to a medium? I would have laughed you out of the room. Now I'm going. So chatting to Carol, because on one occasion she chatted about God, and I said, stop right there, because me and God aren't on speaking terms. Don't try and tell me there's a God, because God shouldn't allow this to happen. And she goes, well, she says that in the same way you talk about the energy or the spirit of the kids, she says, can you think about spirits or energies that died centuries ago and all that they've seen and all that they've encountered that's gone on in the world? They take on that knowledgeable sort of all-seeing, all-knowing presence in the spiritual world, so they're like a god, and that kind of makes sense to me. So I do believe that the spirit of the kids has survived, because the stuff that she knew could not have come from anything or anyone other than the kids. But I still find it hard to wrap my head around, and it hasn't made me religious or anything, but I do believe that when you die, because I think about it, like, what makes you, you know, if you get home in the evening, what makes you think, am I going to, you know, knock together a bit of food? Am I going to have a toasted ham and cheese sandwich, or am I going to order a pizza? Yeah. It's not your skin and bones. It's not your respiratory system. It's not your bones or anything. There has to be something inside you that makes you make that choice. And whether you call it your energy, whether you call it your spirit, I don't go religiously and call it my soul. But something has survived from the kids and was able to communicate to her, because she could not have known some of that information. 100% could not have known. And I, as a rational, like, I went on holidays and I wanted to go on a tour and holiday with my new partner, and the two of us were going and we want to see this, we want to see. And me, I ended up putting that into an Excel sheet so we could make sure that we were going to get everything in for the long weekend that we were going. That's how logical and practical I am.
Yeah.
And I can't put this into an Excel sheet.
You remind me of him 5 years ago. It's when you say your mindset 5 years ago is exactly him. He's like, fuck all that, fuck. Because I went to see a medium. I'm not going to get into any details either. But I went to see a medium a couple of years ago. And I was a huge skeptic as well. And I got it by chance. I got it on a couple of hours' notice over the phone during lockdown. Yeah. So no way she could have done any research. It was just like, your friend's at the pulling out. It's at 3 o'clock. Do you want to do it? Yeah. Yeah. That medium said a lot of things to me as well that nobody could have known. I'm back a skeptic, believe it or not. And I don't know why. But I, to this day, will always say that medium over the phone on a couple of hours notice told me a lot of stuff that nobody knew, especially about me and things in my life that had gone on. So there's something mad.
There's a friend of mine, and he won't mind me telling this story, who was at me. His wife passed away, and he had said, I've heard you chat about the medium and I want to go. And I said, listen, I ain't encouraging you to go. I'm not discouraging you. Make up your own mind. But I believe that the kids were able to
communicate that.
So he went, and he said that the dishwasher had broken and his wife was giving out to him about not taking care of the kitchen, and he should have realised that the dishwasher was making noises or whatever else. And he's sitting there going, how this woman in Scorthy could not know that his dishwasher had been, and he was, sure, yeah, it's got a bit of a rattle, it'll be grand, that his dishwasher had broken.
Yeah.
She was able to tell him the number of the house that he had lived in, and the Paula was saying, listen, sell that house, just get, you know, be gone with it, and all of this crap. There's something to it. Listen, I would know that there's probably bad experiences with mediums, but certainly the experiences I've had have been, yeah, it's lifted me.
Yeah.
And it's made me think that there's something more, there's something after this life, but I can't define it and I can't tell you what it is, but it's definitely she could only have got that information from Conor Darren Carla.
And you've mentioned one or two minor details. They're just the laugh ones. You got talking.
Yeah.
She was able to say stuff. Yeah. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
You
yeah,
just don't
yeah.
actually know. Like, it's crazy. I think we're coming to what to keep you for a long time, Andrew.
Yeah.
Don't think get out here. Fuck this deal. But I can't thank you enough for coming in. Like Calvin said earlier on, our hearts were broke when we couldn't get you in before. We really wanted to get you in, tell your story, and do what you're doing. And I can't thank you enough for being able to sit down, tell that story, and promote Conor's clips as Dara did, and for Carla and the tree projects.
Well, I tell you what, we're on a fundraising drive, and to be quite honest, not just talking about coming in and the opportunity to talk about mental health and the changes and the campaign, but we could really, charities don't work unless they get donations.
Mm-hmm.
So if everybody who listens to this, what's your listenership?
A lot.
So yeah, listen,
a couple of hundred thousand a month.
Listen, if a couple of hundred thousand people put in €3 each, that would fund us for 3 years, 4 years.
Mm.
Listen, please give us a phone. We do great community work. We fund community projects that get people involved. And it lifts me. It keeps Dara's name going, but it does good in communities all across the country, from Donegal down to Cork, Galway, Dublin. I think we've only two or three counties that we haven't funded stuff in, but we're it's good work that we're doing, and I'm proud to say that.
Unbelievable.
I don't know if you said at the start, I was off air, but you said you needed to plug Snowman McCarla a bit more.
That's for me, because it runs in the Independent every year, so hopefully the Indo will run it again this year. We launch it, but I'd love to do something else. I'd sent an email to Lidl, and they had sort of, I was hoping, so Lidl, if you're listening, your corporate social responsibility team, about, I was hoping to do chocolate eggs in the form of, well, it wouldn't be eggs, a chocolate snowman, but that the box would be sort of blank and could be coloured in.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
That's my hope. I may not get that done for this Christmas, but I would hope. And there's a new Lidl opening in Newcastle, where I live soon and where the kids live. So Lidl, if you're listening, will you have a look back through your emails and get on to me, and hopefully we can have some chocolate snowmen with the Snowman for Carla colouring competition on it in the shops, hopefully this year, but definitely hopefully for next year. Definitely hopefully.
Andrew, I actually, this was very daunting coming in, but coming out of it, I really enjoyed speaking to you. And it says more about you that we're leaving here smiling, given the substance we talked about here. So no, keep doing what you're doing, and we'll do what we can to support you. And as Terry said, yeah, thanks for coming in.
No, thank you very much.
All right, take us out on.
Boom.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your whip in it now. Fill your body up. Walk it hard and low. When you finish that.
The hip knocker.
Cut down.